Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is November 30th, 2014, and this is episode 68, Nintendo All-Stars Battle Royale.
Smash your bros, bro!
A GameBuoy.org retrospective on the Super Smash Bros. Series. Welcome again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week we are going to be talking about the game series that everyone seems to be talking about this
week. Call of Duty?
Girl, nobody talks about Call of Duty
anymore. Halo Master Chief Collection?
No one talks about that except to complain about the broken multiplayer.
Oh, wait, on the topic of broken games, we're not talking about Assassin's Creed, are we?
No.
Oh, wait, you told us in the title what we're talking about. Oops. I should pay attention.
All right, well, let's buckle in and get ready for that. In the meantime, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy McWaggy, you want to kick us off?
Yes, Capcom has announced a crossover to tie in with the Madoka Magica movie and Monster Hunter Frontier G. During this event, you can get costume and weapons from the anime series, including Madoka, Sayaka, Mami, Kyoto, Homura, Kyube, and Dessert Witch.
Did you say Kyube?
Contract.
Contract? Oh, man. You know, this actually makes me really upset that I can't play Monster Hunter Frontier G.
Yeah, right?
Because I love Monhun, and I love Madoka Magica, so this would be like a dream come true for me. So, y'all might be familiar with Goat Simulator.
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, the incredible Tony Hawk-style Goat Simulator. I mean, that's really... its name says what it is. Well, anyway, it's getting some DLC. In fact, it got some DLC last week. This is called the Goat MMO Simulator. It is a free expansion that, when you play it, it gives it almost like a WoW-style skin and turns the gameplay experience into like a single-player WoW clone.
Mm-hmm.
The level cap is level 101. There are sheep and goat factions at war. And it really looks... I haven't played this yet, although I do have Goat Simulator.
Yeah, the classes include Warrior, Rouge, and Microwave.
And Rouge, that is not a typo. So it really sounds like they nailed the parody aspect.
Yeah, I watched the trailer. I need to get that.
I need to make sure I have this downloaded so I can play it after the show.
Yeah, same here.
We also have word here at next week's The Game Awards, which we talked about last week. We are going to have the reveal of Metal Gear Online per a series of tweets from series creator Hideo Kojima. In a related note, you know, we had previously remarked about how the Game Awards are trying to sort of break away from the tyranny of, like, the AAA publishers, and, you know, they're really trying to really sort of be more authentic. Well, I just want to real quick point out their five nominees for Game of the Year. We have Bayonetta 2, Dark Souls 2, Dragon Age Inquisition, Hearthstone, and Middle-earth Shadow of Mordor.
Wow.
So, you know...
No Last of Us Remaster?
Yeah, right? You know, as these things go, developers of the year, Blizzard, Monolith, Nintendo, Telltale, and Ubisoft. While I might disagree with Ubisoft's inclusion,
right.
Otherwise, that's actually a really solid, legitimate list. I'm actually kind of excited for the Game Awards on December 5th.
Right? We might have to be watching that with some pizza, maybe some Hot and Ready's. Although that's so, like, Spike Video Game Awards. Maybe we should get, like, a nice hummus or something.
Anyway, we'll talk about that later. But so far, this really does seem to be a legitimate, you know, awards show. And, you know, I actually kind of think...
Yeah, and the words legitimate
like
and
that.
Awards show going together is, like, surprising. Maybe
I mean,
other...
we'll see. If Shadow of Mordor wins Game of the Year, or even Dragon Age Inquisition, although I'm really quite enjoying Dragon Age Inquisition, I'll be a little let down. But if Bayo 2, Dark Souls 2, or Hearthstone win, all of which I think could...
Ooh, and then Daddy Metzen's up there to accept the award. He's like, for the Horde!
I have to tell you, I'm actually really excited to see who they give it to. I really feel
I do have to say I'm really disappointed in the trending gamer category.
Oh, why is that?
Well, there's PewDiePie, who I, you know, maybe controversial opinion I'm not a fan of, but mostly because of Total Biscuit, but I don't want to get really into that here.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why they feel the need to give trending gamers an award. You know, they are also doing, you know, esports players of the year, esports team of the year, and an award for most anticipated game, which is like as AAA as it gets, which is kind of gross. But again, I'm giving them a lot of props.
Oh, there is a best remaster.
I'm giving them a lot of props for doing a last best remaster category that is, you know, it includes stuff like Tomb Raider Definitive, Last of Us, but Halo the Master Chief Collection, Pokemon Ruby Sapphire. So, you know, I'm really excited. I'm eager to see what comes of this.
Yeah, we'll find out December 5th.
We also have word here that indie sensation Hatoful Boyfriend, this is of course the amazing parody of Japanese dating sims where you star as a bird, or as a human, dating birds, is going to be coming to the PS4 and Vita next year.
Yeah, I still need to play that.
They're specifically looking at a window within the second quarter of 2015. Please look forward to it.
Terra Battle has reached 1.2 million downloads, and as part of the Download Starter campaign, Uematsu-san is working on new music for the game. Woohoo!
You know, we've been talking about Terra Battle here pretty regularly over the last couple months. I'm a big fan of this game, and something else that's really exciting is, you know, as they had previously announced on their Download Starter, they did pass the 900,000 download milestone, so the game's incredible soundtrack by Uematsu-san is available for download until February 28th, 2015 on the official Mistwalker Corpse SoundCloud page.
Nice.
So I definitely recommend you check that out. It's so good.
You know, they're getting close to that 2 million console stretch goal.
Yeah, I hope they make it. I actually really enjoy the game. It has beautiful art, beautiful music. I'm into this.
Speaking of Dark Souls 2, a Game of the Year nominee, it has been announced that it'll be coming to Xbox One and PlayStation 4.
I guess it'll be up for Best Remaster next year.
Ah! This re-release is titled Dark Souls 2 Scholar of the First Sin. It includes the current DLC chapters, along with an expanded story, new in-game events, new NPC, and gameplay improvements.
And in related news, there will be a Scholar of the First Sin patch for the already existent release of Dark Souls 2 for PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, and PC. That will be a free update that's going to be releasing on February 5th. In Japan, and the Dark Souls 2 Scholar of the First Sin next-gen version is going to be releasing on April 9th, 2015 in Japan.
Nice. So what my understanding is that if you don't already own it and you prefer to play it on a last-gen or PC, that you can buy it all as Scholar of the First Sin. But if you have it already, you can just get the content.
Yeah. All right.
How thoughtful.
That about wraps it up for the follow-up. Let's move on to some
news. Oh my god, news. All right, so fans of Hatsune Miku will be happy to know that Project Diva F Second is now available for PS3 and Vita. Some very interesting news that we found out right before release was that they are allowing for Japanese save data importing. It's One Direction only, but it can work from like Japanese PS3 version to English Vita version. And I mean, that's really cool that they're, you know, recognizing the Miku fans who really helped her become popular in the States.
Well, you know, to me, this really speaks of something deeper as far as Sega's business plan goes. Sega, you know, we've talked about a lot in the last couple months. Actually, we've really talked about Sega a lot in the entire life of this show.
Our first episode, we talked about Sega.
But more specifically, we've talked recently about how they're trying new things with their business plan, reviving some classics on PC to phenomenal result. And I think that this is just one further extension of that. You know, we hear a lot about people complaining about Sega not bringing the Shining series games to the U.S., not bringing the Yakuza games to the U.S. But in a really real way, this shows us just how close an eye Sega is paying to what Sega games we're all actually buying and playing. And apparently enough importers play Hatsune Miku that they made a special consideration for those people to save their save data. I think that is an incredibly huge statement of support for the fan base, of support for importers, You know, we don't really have from a lot of companies right now. And in a lot of ways, I think it speaks to why we don't see a lot of these other series getting love. And that is very simply that people aren't buying them, much less buying the import copy and the domestic version. You know, a lot of people who I know who personally complain about the lack of Shining games didn't buy the last Shining release that we got here in North America. I believe that was Shining XA. And, you know, Sega has talked pretty openly, pretty candidly about how the last official Shining release in the U.S. sold under 20,000 units. Like, they lost money on that. You know, Sega was in really bad shape a couple years ago. They have turned it around by making smart business decisions. And when I see them doing something like this Japanese save data import process for Hatsune Miku, that really tells me more than all of the complaining about us not getting Phantasy Star Online 2 or what have you. They have a plan, they know who they're servicing, and they are doing their best to treat those players who support them appropriately.
Yeah.
It's hard to... I can't really blame them for the market realities that are preventing them from bringing more games to market in North America. If people aren't paying for this content, well, then they're not going to be able to bring it over because they have people they need to pay so that those people can continue eating and working. And rent.
Would you mind taking this one? I'm a little too terrified of that image.
So one of the big news stories of the last couple weeks is that Assassin's Creed Unity launched as a complete cluster F. This is, of course, kind of tragic. The Assassin's Creed series, as AAA annual releases go, is one that I'm kind of a fan of. I've talked about that here on the show, that generally speaking, I enjoy these games. But this new release, Assassin's Creed Unity, this is the PS4 and Xbox One release. It's just plagued with bugs. It runs really poorly. You're unlikely to have a stable frame rate, much less 60 frames a second. Hell, you're lucky to get 20 consistently.
Ooh.
Characters will often, like, half-render during cinemas, and even during gameplay, you'll see a lot of, like, graphical hitching.
Tell us more about what you mean by half-render.
Oh, well, there's just been a really interesting meme on the internet, and this does pop up in games sometimes, where during cinemas, characters' faces won't render, but, like, their eyes and mouth will.
Yes, and it's so terrifying.
It looks terrifying. Anyway, ultimately, Ubisoft has canceled most of the Assassin's Creed Unity DLC. They've canceled the season pass that they were offering for this game, and instead they're going to be offering the first piece of DLC, the Dead Kings DLC, for free once it's ready. Now, it was supposed to be ready a week ago, but it still isn't. They're still working on fixing the game, much less the DLC. Players who had previously purchased the season pass will be receiving a free Ubisoft game of their choosing between The Crew, Far Cry 4, Watch Dogs, Assassin's Creed Black Flag, Rayman Legends, or Just Dance 2015.
All right.
Ubisoft Montreal and Toronto CEO Yanis Malat says, unfortunately, at launch, the overall quality of the game was diminished by bugs and unexpected technical issues. I want to sincerely apologize on behalf of Ubisoft and the entire Assassin's Creed team. These problems took away from your enjoyment of the game and kept many of you from experiencing the game at its fullest potential.
You know, my thing is that Assassin's Creed 3 was buggy as heck, and Assassin's Creed Liberation had some game-breaking bugs for a long time. So it's not like this is unprecedented in this series, you know. This is with the understanding, of course, that every game is going to ship with a couple bugs, including Karaoke Revolution American Idol Encore 2, which for some reason bugs out when I try to close a five-song idol competition with Avril Lavigne's I'm With You.
Yeah, games are buggy. It's a thing. There's no way they could have QA'd this game properly, because it's happening to pretty much everyone who plays it, and it's a complete crap show. It really seems like a case where they committed to a release date, they weren't ready for it, and they released anyway. As opposed to something like your Karaoke Revolution situation, which is very specific.
Right?
I can understand how that could have slipped through QA. Anyway, in related news, the online component for Halo the Master Chief Collection is currently a bit of a cluster F itself.
Oh, and that's kind of like the draw of this collection for a lot of people.
For a lot of people, yeah. You know, I bought this. I'm really enjoying the single-player campaign. I'm kind of, I guess, a little bit of a fan of Halo, our listeners probably know. So that's not that surprising. What is surprising is that, again, this game shipped with a completely broken online component. You can connect to multiplayer games once in a while, but it's pretty uncommon. It's just an absolute mess. In any event, 343 Industries head Bonnie Ross sent out her heartfelt apologies to players, and it assures us that 343 is dedicated to making this right for the audience, patching the game to work correctly, and making sure that the matchmaking and online multiplayer component is fixed.
Well, let's sure hope so.
We also have word here that Arc System Works is actively teasing via their Twitter that more of their games are going to be coming to PC in the future. This is specifically hot on the heels of their announcement that BlazBlue Continuum Shift Extend is coming to Steam on December 11th.
Nintendo is discontinuing the old Nintendo 3DS LL, or as we know it, the XL model in Japan. So it looks like the new Nintendo 3DS XL and just the new Nintendo 3DS is kind of starting to get into the swing of it being their next handheld.
Well, the new 3DS LL has been the best-selling console, like, pretty much every week in Japan since it came out in October. So, you know, it's already scheduled to, by the end of the year, hit 1.2 million units sold, just the LL version. So, this makes sense to me. If people in Japan aren't buying LL, like regular LLs anymore, then why keep making them?
The funny thing is that I want a regular-sized new 3DS.
Yeah, you've said that before for the faceplates, right?
Yeah.
We also have word here that the Nintendo 3DS has finally been exploited in order to run homebrew games. We're not going to talk any more about that from that angle. Not a big fan of anything that's going to open up piracy on a currently alive system. You know, we've talked about this here on the show. I love when people crack this stuff and hack and add functionality to consoles that are you know, dying or whatever. But the 3DS is still a pretty big deal. In any event, it apparently involves copies of the old launch game Cubic Ninja. As a result, Cubic Ninja is no longer available on the eShop in Japan, and used copies of the game have shot up in price on eBay and Amazon and at GameStop to, you know, sometimes prices higher than $40 for this awful used launch game. So, joy.
Yep, it's $40 on GameStop.com. In some neat news, Ron Gilbert's new 2D adventure game, Thimbleweed Park, has reached its Kickstarter funding goal with plenty of time to go. So they were only looking for $375,000, and as of a few days ago, they had passed that mark. And, you know, there's some stretch goals coming up, with the big one being full voice acting at $625,000.
Ew.
Which is kind of silly because, you know, this is kind of appearing to be a, like, spiritual successor to Maniac Mansion.
Yeah, this game is being designed by original Maniac Mansion designers Rob Gilbert and Gary Winnick. And something that's really exciting, though, is they actually worked with the Walt Disney Company in order to sort of use Maniac Mansion in their promo for this Kickstarter page.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited all around. I know there's a lot of skepticism about Kickstarter in general right now, but this is a project I feel pretty confident in saying this game is going to get made. I'm super excited about that. I have backed this game myself, and if you're interested in Maniac Mansion, and you should be, I would recommend you check this out, Thimbleweed Park.
Excellent. In an interesting twist, Sony is going to be offering a refund to Vita customers due to an FTC settlement where there were some false and misleading ads. This apparently had to do with some remote play, cross-play features on the PS3 that didn't quite pan out. That, you know, now we're seeing on the PS4, kind of full-fledged.
Well, not even necessarily. I mean, that's sort of the basic, yeah. The idea was that, you know, Sony very actively advertised that you'd be able to, like, start a game on your PS3 and then without, like, any interruption, switch over to playing it on your Vita and play it on the go. As most of you know, that's not really how remote play works at all. And even more than that, games that do have, like, a cross-save feature, it's not just like, oh, you just pick up your Vita and you're playing. There's a whole process involved, and this ultimately was found by this class action suit to be a form of, like, a false advertisement. And so Sony now owes anyone who bought a Vita before, I think it was early 2012? June 1st, 2012, a $25 cash/credit refund, or a $50 voucher for select games and services. Sony is apparently going to be emailing eligible customers after the settlement is finalized, and if you're one of those people who feels that this isn't Sony's fault, it appears you will be able to opt out of your settlement, though I'll be honest, I don't know why you would.
Right.
Sony did misleadingly advertise features that didn't really happen.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think. I'm pretty sure that I got my Vita within that range.
We have some awesome Etrian Odyssey news here. The first is the new game, Etrian Odyssey and Mystery Dungeon.
What?
This is a new collaboration title for the 3DS. It is, as you'd likely guess, a Mystery Dungeon game based around the Etrian Odyssey franchise. It looks to marry mechanics from both series into one. So we're looking at, you know, like a top-down roguelike style gameplay, but still with like the mapping and character creation elements of Etrian Odyssey. I'm really, really, really excited for this.
Yeah, and that seems like a good pairing.
On the same day, we also got the announcement of Etrian Odyssey 5. We know nothing about the game. We don't know what platform it's going to be on. We don't know what its release window looks like. Just Etrian Odyssey 5, currently in development.
Atlas really likes their teaser sites for Etrian Odyssey, don't they?
Yeah, well, Japanese developers really like teaser sites, just generally.
Oh, okay.
We also have word here that Jun Takeuchi from Capcom, whom you might be familiar with as the producer on Lost Planet, Onimusha 3, Resident Evil 5, is currently working on a new title, and it is a PlayStation 4 title that is currently unannounced. Takeuchi-san told Famitsu that the title is now progressed quite far, and they expect the announcement for it to come soon.
A new Final Fantasy game is a time travel RPG with that promises to be like a blend of Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy 5 and 6.
I'm just like, didn't we get that with Final Fantasy 13 too?
But it's a smartphone game. This is called Final Fantasy Legends, the Space-Time Crystal, and you're trying to change the future from being destroyed by a god. It is directed by Takashi Tokita, who was one of the directors of Chrono Trigger, so it's not just like a, you know, cash out. It's starring a protagonist named Tomorrow, who interacts with a mysterious girl from the future named Emo, not Emo. But she might be Emo, let's be real, it's a Final Fantasy game.
The same day that that was announced, which, by the by, Final Fantasy Legends, the Space-Time Crystal, is expected to launch this winter. The main story will be completely free, though it will have some microtransaction elements for people who want to enhance the package. We also got the announcement of Square Enix's collaboration title with the developers of the Brave Frontier series. This is A-Lim, and they're working on Final Fantasy Brave Exvius.
What?
Something interesting about Brave Exvius is it will be a gachapon-style free-to-play phone game, but it's going to feature characters from past Final Fantasy games redrawn with completely new, very lush, beautiful sprites, as well as new artwork, new Final Fantasy artwork by Yoshitaka Amano-san.
Hey!
So this is another game that is planned currently to launch this winter in Japan for Android and iOS, and I would expect that we will see both of these titles releasing in North America. There is art available for this game over on Silicon Era. I recommend you check it out. I'm actually really interested, specifically the sprites for like Shadow looks really great, Cecil looks really great, Vivi and Shantoto look really great. I just overall highly recommend you check this out. It got me excited for it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just some really beautiful art for this game. It makes me excited to play it, that it looks so good.
Right?
Brave Frontier is not really my game style of free-to-play phone game, but maybe for this art I'll make an exception.
Excellent. In other Square Enix news, Ryoma Ito, who was a character designer on Final Fantasy Tactics, and Ryo Yamazaki, the composer for Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, The Crystal Bearers, have teamed up to make a new strategy RPG called Heaven Strike Rivals. The twist is that this is out now for Android devices in English. So, like, they kind of stealthily just put this out, and you can get it. It's currently being tested on iOS in some places like Canada.
You know, we see that a lot from Square Enix. They seem to do a lot of regional testing for iOS in Canada. I'm not really sure why that is, but whatever.
Yeah. So if you have some
those
sort of VG Android
Realness
device.
Those hunties need to download it. Let me know how it is.
Right? So yeah, if you have some sort of Android device that can access Google Play, you might have picked it up on the Home Shopping Network over the weekend. Then you should check out Heaven Strike Rivals. Also from Square Enix, we will be finding out sometime in December a new RPG, a brand new RPG. And it's for consoles, it's not a remake, it's from Square Enix. We don't know yet whether it'll be for a handheld or a home console, but
We don't even know if it's a sequel or what. It could be anything. It's actually really
they
exciting.
They say brand new, so, you know. But what...
You know, they say brand new and not a remake. Not a remake tells me, like, that's what they mean with brand new, just that it's a new game. I don't think it necessarily means it's a new IP.
Okay. Well, what President Yosuke Matsuda did say is that it's a project that I've started since I've been inaugurated as the president, and it's finally shaping up. So I'm betting that the not a remake thing is that it's not Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Ah! Well, they're going to start making their announcements in December. They said, we'll come out with a bang and make announcements for it both domestic and internationally. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that we're going to find out what the 2015 Kingdom Hearts release is going to be.
Ooh.
That is pure speculation. I have no kind of knowledge. Just, you know, they've been really spot on about doing an annual release of Kingdom Hearts in some form. And unless they're somehow going to get Kingdom Hearts 3 out in 2015, they're going to need something to take that spot.
Good point.
Well, with all that having been said, I think that's it for our news. Unfortunately, we do have a little bit of...
Man, doing that bumper really hurts my voice.
This bitch, it's pre-taped.
So in some unfortunate news, an unannounced Double Fine Productions game has been canceled and 12 staff were let go after the project fell through with a publisher. This does not affect Broken Age, Massive Chalice, or Grim Fandango Remastered. You know, hopefully for those 12 staffers from Double Fine, they will find great work elsewhere. We hope they land on their feet.
We really hope you guys land on your feet.
And speaking of landing on your feet, or falling off an edge, I guess it's time for us to talk about...
It is time for us to start our discussion.
Super Smash Brothers!
So, we're talking this week about Super Smash Brothers as a series, historically. You know, it's a little bit tough to talk about Smash Brothers without any frame of reference, but we're gonna try. I apologize if this is confusing to anyone out there who's not already familiar with the series. Super Smash Brothers is a fighting game of sorts. You know, that's actually something that is kind of much debated. Is it a party game? Is it a fighting game?
Yeah, we kind of started to talk about that on our fighting game episode.
Yeah. So, you know, for the purpose of this episode, we're gonna refer to it as a fighting game. But something that I think is interesting personally, and I see this mentioned a lot online, is really a lot of us view this as a subgenre of fighting game, sort of like a melee fighting game is what we typically refer to it as. So again, keeping in mind, when we talk about this game as a fighting game, we're not talking about it in the same context as like a Street Fighter or a Tekken.
Mm-hmm.
Although competitive elements do exist within the Smash Brothers scene.
Hi, Hungry Box.
Yeah, right? Most specifically with regard to Super Smash Brothers Melee, which is still actively played at, you know, Evo. So when we're talking about melee fighting games, we're generally talking specifically about a specific type of playstyle. And I just want to talk about that real quick. You know, Smash Brothers 64 sort of set the stage. I don't know that this is specifically owing to the fact that the Nintendo 64 controller had two primary action buttons, but I have to think it does. Typically in melee fighting games, you have two attack buttons. You have a regular attack, you know, for, you know, your basic punches and kicks, often used with the control stick in order to do, like, more focused versions of those attacks. So whereas you might have, like, a very specific kind of forward punch by just hitting your regular attack button, by hitting forward an attack, you'll typically have, like, a more damaging version of your forward attack come out.
Like Falcon Punch!
Well, I'm talking about regular attacks, not special attacks.
Oh,
Falcon
sorry.
Punch is a special attack. And, you know, in the Smash series specifically, that's how you activate what you call your character's Smash, which is the attack that, based on your opponent's damage percentage, is most likely to knock them out of the play field and score you a point.
And that's why it's called Super Smash Brothers, oh my god.
That is, in fact, why it's called Super Smash Brothers. You want to damage your opponent a lot and then hit them with the Smash to knock them out. The other action button, as you might have guessed from what Slaggy was just saying, is your special attack button. And when you use that in addition to using the various direction pads on the various directions on the control stick, you will do different special attacks. You know, in Slaggy's example just now for Captain Falcon, it's like a forward and special is gonna put like his captain his Falcon punch out. Hitting up and special is going to make him do like a leap. And if he runs into another character, he'll grab them and throw them and then bounce off them. Downward and special is going to make him do like a downward burning kick. So, you know, that's for like your flashier, bigger moves. And, you know, your special moves can also knock people out like a smash, though they are not, strictly speaking, smash. You also typically have a trigger, like, or a shoulder button based on what console you're playing this game on that will do like a block, and you'll typically also have a shoulder button that will do like a grab in order to throw like in a typical fighting game. A lot of these melee fighters also will have your jump activated either by tapping up on your control stick or have a button that will activate your jump. A lot of these melee fighters will let you jump with both. Smash Brothers 64, for example, on the Nintendo 64 control pad, several of the yellow directional buttons will just function as jump buttons in addition to tapping up. Melee is the same way with, you know, the beam buttons, was that X and Y, doing jumps in addition to up. So there's, you know, there's a very specific sort of set play style and, you know, sort of game design inherent to this subgenre of fighting that we're gonna see in pretty much all the games we talk about here today. And, you know, typically the focus is, you know, you use these attacks to the best of your ability to deal as much damage to your enemy as possible in order to put them into a position where you can smash them off the stage.
Indeed.
That's all. So, you know, Smash Brothers, just get you started, sort of a real pillar title for Nintendo at this point, one of their biggest properties by far, which is funny because the original game was developed sort of on a whim as like a super low budget project. We'll get into that in a minute, but gameplay differs from like a standard fighting game in that you're not really focused on depleting life bars, you're focused on knocking opponents out of the ring, almost like a
crazy wrestling game with, you know, just really wild stages and wacky attacks and items.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that's another thing. Items come out. Players will often have entire combats based solely on just grabbing items, using them, and throwing them at each other. Again, you know, I understand why this is viewed by the super competitive fighting game scene as, like, that's not a fighting game. But, again, I'm sorry. It's a game where people are focused on fighting each other. Anyway, I want to talk first about Super Smash Brothers for the Nintendo 64. This released in Japan on January 21st, 1999, in North America on April 26th, 1999, and in the EU territories on November 19th, 1999.
Happy 15th anniversary!
Yeah, right? So this was developed by HAL Laboratory.
It sure was.
Whom you're probably familiar with for their work on the Kirby series.
Yep.
You know, something that's really interesting about that is that Kirby was created by Masahiro Sakurai-san, who is also well known as the director of every game in the Smash Brothers series. And this prototype was actually created in the spare time of Masahiro Sakurai-san and Satoru Iwata-san.
Nice.
Who also used to be a developer at HAL Laboratory. They were calling it Dragon King the Fighting Game. And it actually didn't feature any Nintendo characters, because, spoiler alert, we didn't mention it, but the big draw for many people initially to the Smash Brothers series is that it featured a roster of 12 classic Nintendo characters beating the crap out of each other.
Yep.
Saigi, do you want to tell me who those 12 characters were in the original Smash Brothers?
Sure will. That's Captain Falcon, Falcon Punch, Donkey Kong, Fox, McCloud, Jigglypuff, Kirby, Link, Luigi, Mario, Ness, Pikachu, Samus, and Yoshi.
And so, you know, something that's really super noteworthy here, to me at least, is that in this game, you had characters from even, like, some left-of-center Nintendo games, F-Zero
right?
and Earthbound in particular, which...
I mean, those were honestly the first times I became familiar with those series.
Not for me, but for a lot of people, you're absolutely right. And I think that that's something that is really fascinating and probably plays in really big to why people get so amped up about this series is especially people who have a non-AAA take on games in general. It's really easy to get excited about the fact that, you know, there are some really quirky choices of characters here in represented in this game. Characters that really weren't getting a lot of sequels, weren't getting a lot of love, did make appearances in Smash Brothers, and in a lot of ways, we've seen quite a few game series have their profile increased just by their inclusion and focus in the Smash Brothers series.
Yeah, I mean, you even think about something like Samus, and, you know, that in the N64 era, that was kind of a dry spell for the Metroid series, so...
Oh, absolutely. That's a really great point.
And it maybe arguably was her popularity in Smash Brothers that led to the, you know, Metroid Prime games.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not sure that I would say that quite so much, but at the same time, I can't say it's not true. We have seen series get elevated that way. You know, we'll talk a little bit about the Fire Emblem series later. It's so funny because Sakurai-san wanted to include fighters from different Nintendo franchises in order to provide quote-unquote atmosphere. He felt that a home console fighting game would need to have like a gimmick to it. You know, not entirely dissimilar to what Namco Bandai did with Square Enix's fighting game that they did collaboratively with Erkheist, where PlayStation version had a ton of Final Fantasy VII characters in it, as opposed to the arcade version, which only had one or two.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, it was very similar that they basically, Sakurai-san and Satoru Iwata-san, had this really cool fighting game concept, and they were basically like, we need a gimmick to get people to play this, because the game is good, but there's nothing to catch people's eye. And they ended up going with All-Star Nintendo Crossover. And, you know, initially this wasn't even going to release worldwide, which when you think about it now is ludicrous. Again, this is one of Nintendo's key IP.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real pillar title. It moves consoles. This was not actually originally slated for release worldwide, but it was, the word of mouth was so strong. The Japanese pre-order numbers were huge at the time for a Nintendo 64 game. And so they reevaluated and, you know, kind of made history. Now I would say that this game is larger in North America than it is in Japan, like as a series. So I think it's funny to think about how this game really came from very, very humble beginnings.
It really did.
Unfortunately, I don't necessarily have a whole lot more to say about the Nintendo 64 iteration of Super Smash Bros. Slaggy, do you have anything to add before we move on to Melee?
Not really. I mean, just that I remember it being fun, and at the time, you know, I was, 15? I was in high school. Someone who had not had a lot of luck with fighting games, and so this was just a way for me and my friends at the time to have fun. You know, we were big Nintendo fans. We were big Pokemon fans, and so, you know, like, Pikachu and Jigglypuff battles and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, even though at the time I still wasn't that good at it, I would argue I'm not that great even to this day. You know, it was still fun, and, you know, I think definitely making that change from Dragon King to having the Nintendo roster really is what, you know, was the big appeal.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense to me. I really do. I think that for a lot of people, that's probably a pretty standard story. All right, so... Now we get to move on to Smash Brothers Melee, which is where this story becomes a little more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the roster side, and I'm going to say this real quick, I'm going to point this out, because for a lot of people, as you said, Slaggy, roster is a big part of the appeal of this series.
And it keeps growing and growing and growing.
And we saw huge advances on the roster here. The character roster was basically doubled for Melee. We have everyone from the first game, as well as Bowser, Dr. Mario, Falco from Star Fox, Ganondorf, of course, from Legend of Zelda, the Ice Climbers, who obviously come from Ice Climbers, but we also have Marth and Roy from Fire Emblem. We have Mewtwo from Pokemon, we have Mr. Game & Watch from the old Game & Watch Nintendo games, Princess Peach,
and Pichu,
yes, the Pokemon, and Young Link, as well as a gimmick of Sheik and Zelda. This was one selectable character whose down B attack would be to switch roles between Zelda and Sheik.
Yeah, that was a big deal at the time.
This was, of course, Sheik's second appearance in a video game, and it really solidified Sheik as a fan favorite character. You know, Sheik now has a huge fandom, but back in the days of just Ocarina of Time, I don't know that that was necessarily the case. In a lot of ways, it was really Melee that sort of brought Sheik to the forefront of, like, fan craziness. And, you know, something that's really interesting about Marth and Roy from Fire Emblem is that when this game was being developed, Melee, the development team over at HAL Laboratory specifically did not believe that Roy and Marth would be left in for the worldwide releases of this game. Mm-hmm. Marth and Roy were kind of intended to be exclusive for the Japanese version. But during the game's North American localization, the Western localizers, probably some of those Treehouse guys, you know, they were super into the way these characters played. They were really into the story. And so ultimately it was decided to leave these characters in. And you know, it's funny because the Fire Emblem series at that point had never really had a release in North America. But with these characters being featured in Melee, you know, they became really popular, and Nintendo started to take a chance on bringing these Fire Emblem games right. to North America, and now you have where I think most hardcore gamers that you talk to, if you ask them what their favorite 3DS games are, you're going to hear a lot of Fire Emblem Awakening being brought up.
Right.
So again, you know, in its own way, it might not be a proper pillar, but Smash Brothers as a series really elevated Fire Emblem into being a real asset for Nintendo. It really increased the value of that IP.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in any event, Melee had a really interesting sort of development. HAL Laboratory, of course, once again developed it. Masahiro Sakurai-san was the head of production, of course. It was an early release on the Nintendo GameCube.
Yeah, only about a month after launch, right?
It came out in Japan on November 21st, 2001. Came out in North America December 3rd, 2001. Came out in EU territories on May 24th, 2002. And in Australia on May 31st, 2002. And, you know, really one of their goals in creating this was to highlight the advancement of graphics from the Nintendo 64. So, accordingly, HAL Laboratory worked with three separate CGI houses in Tokyo to make the opening CGI sequence. And, you know, this game sort of was created in a very small window of time, and Sakurai-san, and you can kind of tell just by the fact that it launched a mere, like, 2 years after the release of the original right. Smash Brothers, but it has so much more content, so much, like, more depth to the game design. Sakurai-san is called his lifestyle during this period as having been destructive. He took no holidays off. He would only take, like, one-day weekends occasionally, if at all. As a result, they were able to turn the game around. It was only in development for 13 months.
Wow.
Which is ridiculous. Sakurai-san even still looks back on it as the sharpest game in the series. And, you know, still remarks on how good it feels to play that game. This is, of course, held up by the fact that this game is still regularly played in competition at tournaments all over the world, including the much-hyped Evo event every year. And, you know, I say every year, it did take a few years off, but again, it was brought back by very popular demand. There was a whole really incredible event, we talked about it, where Smash Brothers fans raised a ridiculous amount of money for charity in order to bring Melee back to Evo. So this game is super well loved. A really incredible development story that was only in development for 13 months, but they brought out, you know, a way more polished product than something like Assassin's Creed Unity. you know, and on that roster tip, initially the development team was gonna take Ness out and include Lucas from Mother 3. Lucas did eventually get included in Smash Brawl, but they ended up going with Ness just because Mother 3 wasn't out yet. Like, you know, Mother 3, they were going to include Lucas, but Mother 3 ended up being delayed, as I'm sure y'all remember, and so they just stuck with Ness. And it's funny, because now Ness is an absolute mainstay. People would be crying bloody murder if they took Ness out at this point.
Right.
So, also somewhat interestingly, is that toward the end of development, Sakurai-san was approached by Hideo Kojima, the director of the Metal Gear Solid series. You know, he was working with Nintendo on Metal Gear Solid The Twin Snakes for GameCube, and he had wanted Solid Snake to be included in Super Smash Bros. Brawl. Unfortunately, the game was too far in development for his inclusion, but they were able to get him in on Smash Bros. Brawl, quite famously. As you know, one of the first two third-party characters to appear in the Smash Bros. Series. You know, Nintendo presented Smash Melee for the first time at their 2001 E3 event, and they had the game playable at that event. So, like, they were like, oh yeah, hey, we have this game coming, and it's totally super playable. At their then annual Shoshinkai event, which you might also be familiar with as Nintendo Space World, you know, which was, you know, once again, it had just a ton of, like, info dump on new characters, on new gameplay. And Nintendo had, you know, a playable demo available there that already reflected a huge step forward from the demo at E3 just a few months before. So it's just really interesting snapshot of how far this game came in development terms in just a couple of months. And Nintendo at Shoshinkai started, you know, having a playable tournament for fans of the series, which is a tradition that lives on even now. We saw a lot of that happen in the promotion for the recent Super Smash Bros. 4 3DS/Wii U hype machine. Like, there were a ton of tournaments, prizes. It was a big deal. Nintendo really got involved with the fan community, and that's something they've been doing very early. So, Slackick, why don't you tell me a little bit about your experiences with Smash Brothers Melee?
You know, I picked it up right when it came out. I was a launch adopter of the GameCube, and, you know, I've talked about that before. Again, you know, I was never really that great on it. But, you know, it does have a whole single player, it's not just a multiplayer game. You can play it single player against computers. There's, like, different modes you can do. This is the first one to introduce the Final Destination?
I believe so.
Which, you know, that stage is kind of a standby. Final Destination is a stage that, you know, in this game is where you fought the Master Hand, who is considered, like, the boss of the series. So, like I said, you know, I was never really that great at it, but I looked forward to it at the time. I definitely appreciated the bigger roster, and, you know, like, later, once I, you know, met you and Seawolf Jason and Space Pirate Ben, you know, this was still before Brawl had come out, so, you know, that's kind of where I started to be like, oh, damn, people are really, really good at this game. And I had kind of just, you know, previously experienced it as like, oh, it's just fun smacking people around.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because it's funny you had that experience with Melee. You know, I've talked here on the show a little bit about how I had, you know, once upon a time dated a tournament level Guilty Gear player, but he was also, super, super into the competitive scene of Smash Brothers Melee. So he was all about that, like, Final Destination, no items, Fox life. And it was really interesting to learn, like, just how competitive and how serious people took, Smash. For me, it was really eye-opening. I had taken it really competitive to the terms of, like, having crazy, super in-depth, like, you know, 10-hour marathons of just beating the crap out of each other for hours on end with Seawolf Jason and Space Pirate Ben. And also our friend Amanda, who we promise will be on this show at some point. But and Smash Melee was just an incredible experience. And, you know, again, we talk about it as a party game. We've talked about that a couple times earlier in this episode about how, you know, the hardcore fighting game community was not really here for Smash. But, you know, it was a part of the 2008 EVO tournament, like, official roster. And this was a real serious game that people were, you know, competing in. A lot of people view Nintendo's output as, you know, silly or childish, but for me, in a lot of ways, it doesn't get more hardcore than having a game appear in official play at a tournament like EVO.
Right.
And, you know, it, of course, made its premiere at EVO in 2008, its official premiere. Now, they were playing Smash at EVO in years prior to that, but as a side game, not as, like, one of the main games. And, you know, I believe that was the only year it was a main game until 2013, which, you know, ultimately, fans of the Smash community raised $94,683 to donate to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, which obviously is effing amazing in order to win it that spot at EVO 2013 as one of the main competitive titles. And initially, Nintendo of America objected to the streaming of Melee matches, presumably because, you know, they were trying to hype Brawl by that point. But ultimately, Nintendo ended up relaxing. They did let EVO stream. And it's funny because since then, Nintendo has really begun to embrace the competitive community. They've really reached out. They've done a lot of events with folks from EVO. They've done a lot of tournament streaming themselves. And they've really gone whole hog into this. And, you know, obviously, Smash Smash was also included at the Evo 2014 official roster. And, you know, consistently, Smash has the highest number of streaming views of any game on Evo's roster. Like, consistently, every year it's featured, it's like the big get in terms of page views. So it really speaks to just how big of a deal Smash Brothers is as both a pillar franchise and as like a hardcore competitive game, which is kind of crazy when you stop and think about it, but you know, that's all right. Smash Brothers Melee for a lot of people was also the start of focusing on Smash as a series and having incredible music. You know, for the Super Smash Brothers Melee soundtrack, Nintendo recorded a lot of new songs. Well, I shouldn't say recorded a lot of new songs. They recorded new versions of a lot of classic songs, including, you know, some really well-loved titles, some really well-loved songs from Kirby, for example. Green Greens is now like the definitive Kirby song because of Smash. Obviously, you know, they re-recorded some really great music from the Pokemon series. There was an amazing Pokemon medley that played on the Pokemon stage. Mm-hmm. And that's something that has continued, you know, by each iteration of the series. There is an increased focus on new versions of classic songs, and something that sprung from the post-release promo of Melee was having the new Japan Philharmonic do official orchestral arrangements of all of these songs. That is also something that they've done more consistently now for other games, and even for other non-Smash games. In a lot of ways, this is the first time we saw Nintendo really get into high production value orchestral music.
Yeah.
So I want to use this note to segue to a game that is kind of not well loved in the Super Smash Brothers family. I'm talking, of course, about Super Smash Brothers Brawl, the Wii iteration of the Super Smash Brothers series. This was released on the Wii in Japan on January 31st, 2008. So that's what, like 70 years later? North America on March 9th, 2008. Australia on June 26th, 2008. And in the EU territories on June 27th, 2008. And it was a really big deal when Nintendo announced what musicians were going to be coming to play for the score of this game. You know, the main theme was done by Nobuo Uematsu, who is like one of the big names in Japanese game music. They brought on composers to do new arrangements, such as Koji Kondo, Yasunori Mitsuda-san, Yoko Shimomura-san, and Yuzo Koshiro-san. And these people are responsible for some of the most amazing compositions in all of games. You know, obviously Koji Kondo, you know, from all of the old Nintendo classics. Yasunori Mitsuda, you probably know from his work on like Chrono Cross, which is one of the best game soundtracks of all time. Also, Chrono Trigger. Yoko Shimomura-san, you'd probably know from Mario RPG series or Kingdom Hearts. And Yuzo Koshiro, you probably know from, like, Streets of Rage or ActRaiser. Like, these are real luminaries doing incredible new compositions on classic Nintendo songs. Yasunori Mitsuda-san specifically did a new arrangement of the theme from Pikmin 2, as I recall. And it's just amazing. Like, every stage in the game, and there were so many stages at this point, all had multiple songs that you could select. There was a really in-depth, comprehensive sound test mode where you could listen to all of this music. This iteration of the Smash Brothers series also introduced a stage creator functionality, and you could assign any of these songs to play in your custom stage. But Slaggy McWaggy, why don't you reel me in a little bit and tell me about the roster changes from Melee to Brawl?
So in a first for the series, some characters were removed. Dr. Mario, Mewtwo, Pichu, Roy, and Young Link were all removed. Added were a lot of characters. And, you know, that was despite mixed opinions of the games, a lot of positive reception to the additions. There was Pokemon Trainer, Diddy Kong, Ike from the Fire Emblem series, Keen DDD from Kirby, Lucario from Pokemon, Lucas, who was supposed to be in Melee from Mother 3, Meta Knight from the Kirby series, Captain Olimar,
Pit from Pikmin.
From Pikmin. Pit from Kid Icarus. That was a big deal.
That was a huge deal.
Because Kid Icarus was just like, oh, that game from NES and Game Boy era, you know? Like,
yeah, and Kid Icarus was really languishing. You know, there were rumors for years and years throughout the entire lifespan of the GameCube that there was going to be a Kid Icarus remake or revival, and we didn't see anything until Melee was announced. Pit was announced as a playable character. He had a very fresh anime hair, like, character design, a voice acting by, you know, a reasonably popular Japanese voice actor. And if it was like a real revival of the character, which, you know, obviously led to the also successful 3DS Kid Icarus Uprising. But again, you know, I get ahead of myself. Why don't you continue?
So let's see, we had Pit, and then where we start to see a bunch of fan service is with Rob, the robotic operating buddy from games such as Gyromite and Stack Up.
Ugh. And only those two games.
that's why I said that.
Rob, of course, is noteworthy because he, you know, wasn't a video game character. Rob is a...
He's a robotic operating buddy.
Well, yeah, he's a physical device that whose sole existence and reason for being was basically so that Nintendo could sell the Nintendo Entertainment System as a toy rather than a video game after the video game industry crash of the early 80s. So Rob is, it's an integral piece of Nintendo's history in North America, but it's really interesting that they included him because it was sort of the first inclusion of a character that wasn't really a character, like not a video game character.
Right.
So, and I think to date, he's the only character like that, but I'm happy we have him. I love the way Rob plays.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, continue.
So, in response to Young Link being removed, Toon Link was put in his place, which, you know, kind of the same thing, but with the cell shading and design of the acclaimed Wind Waker, which, you know, it's weird to say that, but it was acclaimed. Wario made his introduction here, along with Wolf from Star Fox, and then in a twist on Zelda's gameplay, Samus had a final smash in this game where you could transform into Zero Suit Samus, and then vice versa. And then, as previously mentioned, there were the first third-party introductions in this game in the form of Solid Snake from Metal Gear and Sonic from Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic was actually the result of a voting message board, something or other, and he was the most requested character, so Sonic made it in.
And something that's interesting, as an aside, is that Brawl... Also, during the development of Brawl, Sakurai-san briefly considered adding Miis as playable characters.
Oh, yeah.
But he was concerned that, you know, Miis didn't necessarily look right fighting, and more specifically, he didn't want people creating Miis of people they didn't like and then beating them up. Like, he just felt like that would be too mean-spirited for Brawl, to, like, bully character, like, Miis of people you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
That'll become a little more interesting a little later on, but I just wanted to make that note while we were talking about roster.
Indeed.
The fan poll that you were discussing was in Japan, and Japanese fans were asked to submit what their ideal characters and favorite music themes were for potential inclusion. And Sonic, as you say, was the winner by a landslide, as I understand it. So, you know, unfortunately, we're talking about everything about Brawl but the game. That is because Brawl, in a lot of ways...
It's slow, it's floaty...
Yeah, it lacked a lot of the
precision.
Polish and precision of Smash Brothers Melee. Sakurai-san very specifically was designing Brawl to sort of take a step back away from how hardcore Melee was.
Well, I mean, that was kind of the Wii's modus operandi, right?
Well, yeah, to sort of Blue Ocean, bring new gamers in and make people feel comfortable who have never held a
See also Mario Kart Wii, which, you know, we recognize as probably the weakest in the series.
Whatever. That game has a lot of people that love it, and I haven't spent enough time with it to really speak ill of it.
Anyway.
But Brawl, I have played all the way through Brawl multiple times. You know, we haven't talked too much about single-player components in these discussions, Smash 64 had a very basic mode where, you know, it was almost like a classic fighting game. You played against eight characters, and then you fought against like a metal iteration of one of the characters, and you fought against a squad of one of the characters, and then you fought a giant floating hand that represented sort of like the player
the
in
puppet
this
master.
Well, yeah, because the setting for Smash is that
they're toys.
You're all a bunch of toys in a kid's imagination come to life, and the hand is the hand of the puppet master, as you say. Melee took it a step further. It brought in like an adventure mode that was a little bit more like a platformer game. But Brawl really blew all that out of the water with a super, I would even say excessive, mode called Subspace Odyssey. Subspace Odyssey had a
Emissary.
Story. Oh God, I said Odyssey.
Yeah, you were
Subspace
doing the, you were doing Emissary. The C with Jason mix up.
Ah! Subspace.
Actually, he
Emissary.
Said embassy. He called it the embassy.
Oh, he did.
Love you, Seawolf Jason.
Anyway, Subspace Emissary was about, you know, sort of an invasion from another realm of some invaders. I don't really know, like, their official names, but I have to assume they're coming from subspace and that their leader is the Subspace Emissary, IDK. All I know is that it had some really incredible CGI cutscenes that gave me so much life and a super Kirby-inspired world to explore. And, you know, the Kirby element really came through toward the end. The last area of Subspace Emissary, and this thing is, you know, quite a few chapters long. And then the last chapter is as long as every chapter before it. And so whereas before you're doing sort of vaguely game-specific themed chapters where you explore an environment sort of based on that game series, often with a boss from that game series. So like, Samus is running through, you know, metal spaceship corridors with a boss fight that comes out against Ridley. You have Lucas and Ness who are fighting Piggy in a giant robotic contraption.
Mm-hmm.
The end phase is just like this huge map with like every door has like a door that leads to another map in like a very NES style or Kirby style, like just huge, like multiplanar area where you have to re-beat bosses, unlock more characters who have been turned into trophies by what I think is the Subspace Emissary, IDK, and ultimately fight against the Subspace Emissary in a really incredibly hard fight if you're playing on one of the harder difficulties. Again, the real draw to Subspace Emissary is that it's first off the primary way to unlock all of the characters in the game, and second that it has some really awesome, super fun cutscenes. I would recommend that you load these cutscenes up on YouTube because to watch them in your Wii or Wii U would involve putting Brawl into your Wii or Wii U.
Oh!
You know, I'm really not a fan of Smash Brothers Brawl. I think it's really a mess.
I mean, I think it kind of speaks to the mess, as you say, is that you imported it and we were playing your import copy for, like, you know, the couple months before it was released over here in America. And by the time it was released domestically, you know, we all bought it, but
I didn't even buy it. Like, by the
oh,
time
you didn't?
No, by the time the US version came out, I had already had it. I went back to Melee.
Oh, that's right. I think that I eventually lent you my copy of Brawl.
That probably happened, yeah.
Recent Nintendo Wi-Fi connection closures. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just one of those things where I just don't think it's a great game. My problem is, if Brawl happened on its own, it would probably be well loved. But because it came after Melee, and for a lot of us, it felt like a step back, and I say that way before the competitive scene had anything to say about it, because I hear people like, oh, that's just the competitive scene and classism, or, you know, something. Like, I just don't jive to that. I just think that even to a layman, if you've spent hundreds of hours on Melee, Brawl mechanically feels like a step back.
Well, and did you talk about the kind of janky development history of it?
Why don't you get us started on that? Because that was my next step.
Well, the thing with Brawl is that it was announced at a pre-E3 conference in 2005, you know, back when Nintendo was still doing E3 conferences, and it was announced by Iwata-san, who at that point had advanced to the presidency of Nintendo, and he said, oh yes, the next Smash Brothers is in development, it'll have Wi-Fi compatibility, we're hoping it to be a launch game. And this was a surprise to Sakurai-san, because he'd been he had left Hale Laboratory back in 2003, and you know, I guess at some point after he had left, and, you know, I'm guessing that's around the time Iwata had transitioned away as well, said, oh yeah, if we make a new Smash game, that Sakurai would be in charge. So then, after the conference, Sakurai-san gets a call and says, you know, we need you to go to Iwata-san's hotel room. And then Iwata-san says, oh, we'd like you to be involved in this game, possibly near the level of director.
Which,
and,
hello, that's ridiculous.
And Sakurai-san was like, okay. And so this game actually was not in development, even though Iwata-san had said it was.
Until October 2005.
And so they worked with a lot of outside studios, because, you know, this was the first one to not be done by HAL. It was kind of just a mixture of different teams.
Well, it was actually primarily Sora. Game Arts.
Yeah, Sora was, you know...
Well, the thing about Sora is that Sora was the development studio that Nintendo opened specifically for Sakurai-san. Like, they basically, in their deal to get him for this game, they basically gave him a development studio to head. Like, that's really the origin of Sora.
Right, and then there was Project Sora for Uprising, but basically, that's right, aside from Medios with Q Entertainment. But that's a conversation for another day.
So, and you know, most of the staff that worked on Brawl came from Game Arts.
Game Arts, yeah.
Who, up to this time, their work was on some really well-loved games, such as Grandia, the Lunar series, Gun Griffin, Sylphheed, Gun Griffin Blaze. Something that you might notice about this list of games, though, is that none of them are fighting games. They are JRPGs and shooters. So.
Yeah, I mean, their most recent one that you're probably familiar with is Ragnarok Odyssey.
But again, my point is, especially when Brawl was made,
right?
If we're going to talk about the quality of gameplay and the step down from Melee that is present, you have to consider it wasn't made by HAL Studios. It was made by a studio, primarily made by a studio, that was known for JRPGs. So
maybe that's why the Subspace Emissary was kind of cool, though.
Right? And they worked with Nobuo Uematsu-san, and man, just really incredible stuff.
It was really ambitious, but, you know, it just didn't quite deliver. And like I said, I'd be interested to hear from people whose first exposure to this series was Brawl, because maybe they view it totally differently.
Yeah, in fact, hashtag GameBuoy Extra. Are you a Smash Brothers fan? Was Brawl your first Smash? If either of these things are true, you should tweet at us at GameBuoy.org. The .org is spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
The .org is spelled D-O-T-O-R-G.
And you should tell us your thoughts on Smash Brothers, on Brawl in particular. I'd also be interested in any such data, like, you know, who do you like to play? What are your favorite stage? I love talking about Smash. So Brawl, bit of a mess. You know, it obviously took several years later than Nintendo indicated it would be.
But, you know, at this point, it had cemented itself as a mainstay series.
Oh, absolutely. It was a huge deal. And every new character reveal was a big deal.
Was this the first time that they utilized the
power of social media and the internet?
Well, what is the actual name that he uses for it? Well, I mean, this generation was a lot of it was done on Miiverse, but the Smash Dojo.
Well, yeah, the Smash Dojo made its debut with Smash Brawl, and Sakurai-san did daily updates every day or every weekday, I should say, because I don't think they updated on weekends.
Right.
Every weekday for years, they updated their website with a ton of in-depth game information, talked a lot about design philosophy, highlighted various composers or individual songs, and really kept people talking about their game every day for years. And I think this was a huge, huge part of why Brawl, you know, and this is a double-edged sword, because Brawl, people were frothing at the mouth for this game. Like, people wanted Brawl so bad.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a lot of backlash when the game turned out to be the game that Brawl is.
Yeah, and, you know, this is where Project M kind of comes into play, the mod.
So Project M, and I wasn't necessarily intending to talk about Project M here on this episode, but okay, we can get into that. Project M is a mod for Smash Brothers Brawl that basically seeks to make Smash Brothers Brawl play more like Smash Brothers Melee, which is what the M in Project M stands for. The original project was going to be called Super Smash Bros. Plus, but then when that team disbanded, the people that were on that team ended up sort of forming Project M and focusing rather on making Brawl like a bigger, better experience, just tightening it up, making it more like Melee. From a gameplay standpoint. You know, we haven't talked about a lot of the advanced techniques in Melee. There were some really interesting things, such as when you dodge in the air in Melee, you can dodge in a different direction than your momentum is carrying you. That was changed in Brawl so that you keep the trajectory you're currently going on, you just have a handful of frames of invincibility. There was a technique called wave dashing, where you would jump and then, or do a little hop, and then immediately dodge downward into the ground in order to, like, slide along the ground. And if you do it repeatedly, you get a lot of invincibility frames and move super fast. It's almost more of a glitch than, like, a real legitimate technique. And, you know, they basically wanted to bring all of this stuff that was taken out of Melee and bring it back to Brawl, to make Brawl a more technical game along the lines of what Melee was doing. This is, of course, something that if you're interested in it, you can check them out. This mod has a huge community. Their official website is projectmgame.com. You have to have a modded Wii in order to run it, but as far as I understand, at least it used to be the way that you still had to be running a Melee disc in order to play the game. You could not pirate. Or, I'm sorry, a Brawl disc. You couldn't just pirate Brawl and play it that way. You had to have the disc and just be running this mod via an exploit in the stage creation menu, I think.
Oh, huh. And, you know, this isn't something that, you know, is EVO level, but a lot of tournaments do have Project M.
Yeah. In fact, you know, there were some people trying to get it into EVO, but that is not really EVO's thing. So, either way, I have to say, and I want to wrap this up talking about Brawl, because we're talking a lot about Brawl without really saying much, but ultimately, it was, I felt, a disappointing game with unparalleled production values for the time. Nintendo really spared no expense in making this what they tried to make as the biggest, best game in the Smash Brothers series. And again, from a presentation standpoint, they did not fail. Slaggy, do you have anything else to say about Brawl?
Not really.
All right, well then, let's talk now about the last entry in this discussion. That is Super Smash Bros. For Nintendo 3DS and Wii U. It was released on 3DS in Japan on September 13, 2014, in North America and the EU territories on October 3rd, 2014, and in Australia on October 4th, 2014. It was released on the Wii U in North America on November 21st, 2014, in the EU territories on November 28th, 2014, in Australia on November 29th, 2014, and it will release in Japan on December 6th, 2014.
It's so weird to
see
that.
So it is not out yet in Japan.
Yeah, I was just gonna say.
I don't think it's that weird. This is happening increasingly often, and every time you say it's so weird, but it's,
no, it's
not
just that,
that weird
we've already
anymore.
Played it. Anyway.
Slaggy, if you'd like to update that roster for us.
All right. So, I'll start off with the interesting element. Well, I mean, I guess there's a lot of interesting elements. That Mewtwo will be a downloadable character, as we reported, if you buy both versions, which I think a lot of us out there have done. And then returning after being omitted in Brawl is Dr. Mario.
Oh.
Yeah, so he was a returning character. There were a couple who have, who had made an appearance in Brawl who are not returned. And that's the Pokemon Trainer, which we'll get to in a minute for reasons. Wolf and Ice Climbers is one of the, big ones. Solid Snake and Lucas. And then, you know, Pichu, Roy, and Young Link did not return from the previous.
So it needs to be said that Ice Climbers, very specifically, and this is official word from Masahiro Sakurai-san, the Ice Climbers did not come over to the new iterations because of hardware limitations with the 3DS version of Smash Bros.
That's interesting.
Now, he said, you know, they had the Brawl version of him up and running in the Wii U version super easily, but they just could not get it to work on the 3DS version, because with four players on character, you had eight characters on screen at a time, running AI for all of them. It was just too much for them to do on the 3DS.
Yeah.
The 3DS needs to be pointed out, though, it is a technical marvel All of the characters are locked at a solid 60 frames a second, and the game feels like a real Smash Brothers. A lot of people were very concerned because it was the series' first release on a platform.
Like the fan game Super Smash Land?
I think people did. Anyway, let's get back to the characters. Slaggy, what characters were new to the Smash franchise?
Well,
I was called it the Smash-shies.
Smash-shies, Well, one of the very notable additions was Bowser Jr. You know, Bowser Jr. is often a fan favorite, but the big deal for a lot of us, I think, was that the Koopa Kids, not the Koopa Kids as in Koopa Club, but the Koopalings, as they're often known as well, are the alternate costumes, which are Larry, Morton, Wendy, Iggy, Roy, Lemmy, or Ludwig.
And something that needs to be said about alternate costumes as well is that Smash Brothers 4, I'm just going to say 4 as a way to abbreviate, so I'm not saying 3DS and Wii U every time, really finally brought a focus on alternate costumes for a lot of characters. We previously saw
Pikachu in a party hat.
Very few characters getting alternate costumes, to the point that Pikachu wearing a party hat or goggles was notable. And that's because Nintendo didn't want to do different colored Pokemon for various reasons. Probably because of how rampant rumors were of, like, Pika Blue and what have you, back in the early days of the Smash franchise, you know, coinciding with the early days of the Pokemon franchise. So I guess they just didn't want to release any official, like, different colored Pokemon, so they went with accessories. Jigglypuff with a hat, etc. Or a bow. And we did in Brawl see two different forms of Wario. Wario had an alternate costume based on his
WarioWare
or Wario Land appearances. So that was really cool. But we really finally saw Nintendo embrace that with Smash 4.
Indeed. To the point where, like, these are, like, straight up different characters if you select them. And you were kind of able to do that with Peach and Zelda for...
But that was an active... You mean Sheik and Zelda, but that was...
Sheik and Zelda, and Samus and Zero Suit Samus, where you could select one or the other on the character select ring.
Well, but again, you had to select a character and then, like, hold a button combination. It wasn't just select them, they have their own icon. It was almost like a secret to start off as them. Obviously, they both have gameplay mechanics that lead to those characters coming into play.
Right, but this is, like, just straight up, oh, Bowser Jr., instead of being, like...
Gets a different
Captain
gameplay.
Falcon, instead of being like Captain Falcon and just giving him pink and purple outfit, which is my favorite costume for Falcon, you just straight up play as a different Koopa Kid. Man, like, Bowser must have like 9 children. I was just thinking about that. The Koopa Kids, Bowser Jr., and Baby Bowser. Anyway, Dark Pit.
From Kid Icarus Uprising.
Duck Hunt.
Of course, the fan community refers to this as Duck Hunt Dog. We've talked about this here on the show. Duck Hunt is not only the Duck Hunt Dog, but also the Duck Hunt Duck on his back working as a duo.
Right, and a shoo-in for a Banjo-Kazooie franchise.
Like I said week, I need that to happen.
Greninja, a popular new Pokemon. Little Mac from the Punch-Out series, really big fan service. And, you know, Punch-Out had the Wii release, but...
And, you know, something really cool about Little Mac is that he does have multiple alternate costumes, including a green wireframe version that is based on the Nintendo Arcade Classic Punch-Out. And a version that has the pink hoodie from the interstitials that occurred in the NES version of Punch-Out in between circuits.
Yep.
So real fan service there.
Lucina from Fire Emblem Awakening. Mega Man, which,
yeah,
you know,
this
that was a big
was a big deal. Nintendo doing more with Mega Man than Capcom.
And then, as we alluded to from Brawl, they did not include Miis in Brawl, but in Smash 4, they included the Mii, which could be customized as a Mii Brawler, a Mii Sword Fighter, or a Mii Gunner. And I have to say, they're actually all pretty fun.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of
these
the
cannot
way that
be
the
used
Miis
in
out.
Like the competitive online play, but like for like the, you know, ranked matches. But they're really fun. There's Puckman, better known as Pac-Man, from the Pac-Man series. Palutena from Kid Icarus. Robin from Fire Emblem as both male and female versions.
You might be familiar with Robin as the My Unit.
Yep.
Unit from Fire Emblem Awakening.
The protagonist, arguably, I guess. I'm only part Fire Emblem, blah, blah, blah.
Did they call it My Unit in the North American release?
They called it My Unit, yeah.
Okay.
It's My Unit. Are we talking about My Unit? Rosalina and Luma.
From the Mario Galaxy subseries.
Kind of a, some people say it almost a replacement for the Ice Climbers in the way that they play.
Yeah, they play very similarly to Ice Climbers, except that the Luma does not have nearly as much, like, interactive AI as Ice Climbers. It's a very similar concept, but Luma is more of an interactive item than, like, a second player character.
Right. There's Shulk from Xenoblade Chronicles.
Which is exciting as heck, with an alternate costume of him in his underpants.
I thought they were swim shorts.
I think they're underpants.
Okay. And then the villager from Animal Crossing, available in the Boy and Girl Villager. And similarly, Wii Fit Trainer, available as the male and the female Wii Fit Trainer. This is along with, you know, a majority of the returning roster from Brawl and, you know, the other game as well.
Yeah.
So it's a total of 51 on disc and one already confirmed for DLC.
And I have to be honest, I don't say this a lot, but I want more DLC for this game. So I hope they blow the damn doors out. These games typically go, you know, 6-7 years between iteration. So I hope they can give us enough content to make this game amazing for the next 6 or 7 years with the way we consume games nowadays.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting that this game is released both on the 3DS and the Wii U. Sakurai-san began development almost immediately after he completed his other project, Kid Icarus Uprising.
Right.
Of course, he did that with Sora, with a sub-staff of Sora, and he also
Project
worked...
Sora.
Well, yeah, but again, they work under Sora Ltd.
Right, right.
So... specifically, he, rather than working with Game Arts on this new iteration, he went to a fighting game company, specifically Bandai Namco Games.
Well done.
And sort of organized staff from the teams that work on Soul Calibur and Tekken specifically to work with Sakurai-san on the development of Smash 4. In the previous iterations of the Smash series, Sakurai-san himself actually taught himself to play the Smash Brothers games one-handed so that he could have competitive matches with himself in order to test every aspect of balance.
I would like to watch that.
Right? Well, he actually developed really, really bad carpal tunnel doing that.
Oh, boy.
Like, his hands and wrists are supposed to be really jacked up at this point. But he, for the first time, sort of worked with, specifically these Bandai Namco folks also on working on balance details. And as a result, you know, the game really, in a lot of ways, I personally feels like a really incredible sort of combination of the good elements from Brawl and Melee.
I agree.
I think it feels tight like Melee with the crazy production value and sort of everything but the kitchen sink design of Brawl. The only thing that's missing, to me, is that there is no Subspace Emissary equivalent. You know, very specifically, Sakurai-san said that he just wanted to do the cool reveal trailers that we've been talking about every week, practically, for the last 2 years, because he was very disappointed that the first thing fans did with Subspace Emissary was upload the videos to YouTube. And so effectively people were enjoying them outside the context of the game, and he just didn't feel like it was worth putting development assets and resources toward this thing that people weren't even enjoying as a part of the game. So he specifically didn't do cinemas for the actual game, although the Wii U version of Smash 4 does have HD video, an HD video gallery of all of the reveal trailers, which admittedly are pretty freaking cool. With some really incredible production value. Like, who else here during the Palutena reveal anime trailer thought there should be a Kid Icarus anime?
Pretty much.
So, you know, one of the things that people really disliked in Brawl was that there was a mechanic called tripping, where your character would... It was something ridiculous, like one out of every 1,064 steps or something. Like, you would just randomly trip. Which, for a competitive game, having characters randomly do anything... kind of completely breaks strategy. Like, that's a big problem, even if it happens very infrequently. So Sakurai-san confirmed, you know, that was going to be removed. They specifically worked really closely with the competitive community and the fan community at large to get a lot of design feedback on what people wanted from the gameplay of Smash 4. And, you know, again, it really shows they've done all of this cool community outreach stuff. They've done tournaments practically every other month. And, again, you know, they really set their sights, Nintendo and Sora and Bandai Namco, on making a game that is inclusive in the way that they wanted Brawl to be, while still being competitive and technical in the way that Melee was. Sagi, do you have anything to say?
You know, I've only been playing it for about a week now, but really impressed. I really feel like that You know, I'm starting to, like, I think it's a little more accessible than Melee in terms of being, like, hardcore. But, you know, definitely, I feel like I'm learning to play the game well, I hope.
Excellent.
And, you know, just, it feels really tight. You know, the characters that I am familiar with control, like, you know, I remember them too in the other games. So, you know, and the new characters have some really compelling controls too. Like, Pac-Man is really interesting. Like, and I'm really a fan of Robin as well.
Excellent. Yeah, you know, and we talked a little bit about how Zelda and Sheik are now separate characters. Samus and Zero Suit Samus are now separate characters. There's no, like, inner character changing anymore. And, you know, a big part of that was actually because of the Nintendo 3DS limitation. Again, having these mid-match transformation characters actually turned out to be a big problem as far as loading all of these characters into the game's RAM and having them just chillin', in case they need to be swapped out. I guess the game just could not handle that. So it's really interesting to think about the various ways that the game design was influenced by the decision to do a Wii U version and a 3DS version. Interestingly, the reason why they released at different dates was so that each game could have its own independent debugging period, where the entire debugging and QA team was focused on just one game at a time. So in that prioritization really led to both games, I think, coming out really smooth. I haven't had any kind of technical issues or bugs. I've been playing the 3DS version since it launched in Japan. You know, I've talked about that here on the show. And I've had no real technical issues at all. I've had a very, very pleasant, positive experience playing this game. I know there's still some amount of discussion in the tournament and competitive community about whether this game will be, quote-unquote, the new Melee. But unfortunately, it's really just too soon to say. We're really going to have to see how the sort of matchups come out, how sort of the high-level play develops. But I'm personally very optimistic. I think this could be the next big Smash competitively. I'm very impressed with the game. And, you know, again, I played probably 10 hours this weekend alone. I can't get enough of this game. And I'm really excited to see sort of what's next now that the game can be enhanced with DLC.
And Amiibo.
Oh, and Amiibo. You know, that's something we haven't even talked about, is that this was also the premier game for Nintendo's interactive figure line. I myself have bought 8 Amiibo so far. And I have to say, I personally am a big fan. So far, the Amiibo in Smash Bros. 4 is specifically to unlock, like, little, like, AI characters that you build and grow by playing with them in certain ways. By which I mean literally, supposedly, the AI routines will learn specifically how to play against you so that they can be, like, an optimal training partner. And then you can take your Amiibo over to your buddy's house and play against his Amiibo, and they'll both learn from each other sort of like how to play a more varied in-depth way. I don't know how I feel about all that, like, in terms of can that really be true, but I can say for me, I did definitely have a match against my Marth Amiibo where one match I was attacking him using largely air attacks, and I swear to God, the next time I played that Amiibo, his air game was so good that I had to find a new tactic.
Wow.
So I don't know that that's true. I do know that my Amiibo at level 29 destroys the highest AI computers. So I'm very interested in seeing. You know, we also have stories about how Amiibo are now winning tournaments in Smash Brothers. this is a real thing that's happening. So very, very interested in that angle, too. Good way to bring that up, Slag.
I also think it's kind of cute because it really seems like it's full circle with the Smash lore, the little bit of Smash lore that there is, being, like you said, based around the idea that these are just toys that are being played with from a toy box by a child. And so now you literally have the toys that they look like assist trophies and such. So
something else I love about Amiibo is that all of the Amiibo of Smash characters, which is all of them so far, are in the same pose as their in-game trophy is in Smash 4. And I just think that that's very, very cool. It's a nice little detail, which, you know, Nintendo detail, of course. But it's just very cool, and I have to admit, you know, initially I was very conservative. I only ordered one Amiibo, it was the Marth one. But I ended up enjoying playing with it so much in-game that I ended up going to Toys R Us and taking advantage of a buy 3 for $30 rather than, you know, $13 or $12.99 or whatever. And I could not help myself, ended up buying 6 there on the spot.
Yeah.
So, again, you know, I'm a big fan of Smash Bros. 4. I think it's a great game.
Smash Tour. Very fun.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about it. So, in place of Smash Brothers Brawl's Subspace Emissary, we now have a new handful of single-player options, several of which can also be enjoyed multiplayer. And since I didn't mention it before, Subspace Emissary did have a multiplayer component. You could play two-player Subspace Emissary.
Yeah.
And in fact, I played through it two-player in full three or four times. Just any time we were working on a new Wii, and then a Wii U, also my import Wii, we played through that game quite a few times.
Yeah.
So, anyway, one of the new modes was the Smash Tour, which is like a board game take on Smash. You go around a board collecting power-ups and new characters, and whenever two players on the board collide, all four players get into a fight.
Ah!
I think it's a lot of fun. I've seen a lot of people online, like, complain about it, like, oh, stupid waste of time.
It's cute.
But I think it's fun. I think it's, it's not competitive in, like, the competitive gameplay.
But it's like, oh, I want to get that.
It's competitive in the fun way, yeah.
I want to get that Dr. Mario character that just dropped.
Right? And I've
Spike got to it first.
I've also unlocked a lot of the collectible trophies, and one of the new gameplay functions in Smash 4 is that you can customize characters and unlock new abilities for them and assign those abilities to override your other special attacks. And I found Smash Tour to be one of the easiest ways to unlock a lot of new abilities for various characters at one time. You spend a little bit of time in Smash Tour and you unlock as much as you would in other modes in half the time. So I think it's cool. I think it's a lot of fun. And I expect I'll play it a lot more in the future.
Yeah. Can you tell us really quickly about Smash Run and Street Smash for the 3DS?
Is Street Smash the Street Pass thing?
Yes.
So you create a character in Street Smash that is like a spinning top almost, and then your character sort of fights other smashers that you see on the street, and you get, gold and stuff as rewards when you win.
Cute.
It is pretty cute. Smash Run is the closest thing to Subspace Emissary in either version of Smash 4. It is a giant platforming map that you go through while collecting power-ups and stat bonuses. You have like a limited amount of time to like collect as many power-ups as possible and get to the Smash Arena. And when you do get there, you then have you have it out in a regular Smash mode with all of the stat bonuses and items that you picked up during your run through the 2D platforming map. And this is a huge map.
Yeah, it's based on Kirby Air Ride, isn't it?
I'm not familiar with a version like, with a mode like that in Kirby Air Ride, but
it's apparently the city trial mode.
Yeah, I haven't spent much time with Kirby Air Ride. I played it literally 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So, I'm not familiar with that mode, but okay.
That's what apparently it is. All right.
Also, from a game. Yeah. So, all right. I think that's all of the big hits. The online functionality of Smash 4 has been greatly increased. There is now two modes. One is called For Fun and the other is For Glory. For Fun, all of the stages, all of the items are turned on. And For Glory, you're playing only on, like, the Final Destination stages and Final Destination stages that are altered to have, like, music and graphics from other stages, which is a pretty cool function. For Fun is just meant for people who are a little more casual like us that just want to play for fun. And as you may have guessed, For Glory is for, like, the more competitive players who take the game super serious and really want, like, a competitive, serious fight.
And seems like tailor-made for Evo.
Right? Well, a lot of people were saying, having a For Glory mode really feels very specifically like they are catering to the tournament crowd with that. So I'm very interested in that. I love that they included it as a feature. Something else that we didn't talk about that popped up in Brawl for the first time was a new item called Assist Trophies.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When you use an Assist Trophy, you get like an NPC AI-controlled computer player who interacts with the stage typically almost in the form of like a playable character. Every now and then you'll have one that isn't like a playable character, but most of them are like almost like a new character comes out and interacts with the stage.
Yeah, really kind of taking its DNA, I feel, from the Pokeball item.
Yeah, and the Pokeball item is an item that appeared since the first game. You throw a Pokeball, a Pokemon comes out and wreaks a character-specific kind of havoc based on whatever Pokemon comes out of the Pokeball.
Like, oh, an Electrode, it casts self-destruct.
Yeah, exactly. So, Assist Trophies came along in Brawl, and they were, even more of them showed up in Smash 4. And something interesting about Smash 4 is that both versions have some assist trophies in common and some that are specific to that console.
Yeah.
It's just really fun stuff. I love assist trophies. I can understand why the super competitive guys don't, but to me, they're fun. I like them. And you know, when a assist trophy pops up on a stage and everyone's focus becomes, I need to get that damn assist trophy, it leads to some really crazy antics that I have a lot of fun with personally.
Yeah.
So, all right, I think that's everything, Slaggy. Can you think of anything we're missing?
No, just that it's a bright chapter for the future of the franchise. And, you know, at this point, we don't even know what Nintendo has in store for their next console. We're kind of just enjoying the 3DS and Wii U, you know, finally getting the attention that both of them deserve. And
I wouldn't argue that the Wii U is getting the attention it deserves yet.
Well,
it's getting more attention, so that's good.
It's starting to get there, so, you know. That I think these will both be games that will be enjoyed for a long time to come.
Excellent, excellent. All right, I want to wrap this conversation up then. You know, something I like to talk about in these retrospective episodes specifically is to talk about clones and similar games.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's interesting about Smash Bros. Is that it's generally considered as, like, the progenitor of the, like, melee fighter subgenre, as I discussed earlier. And, you know, so I just wanted to spotlight some of these. In case you're super into Smash Brothers and you want a little more, you know, these are some games that you might want to look into. So the first game that I would cite here is probably Kirby Fighters. This was, of course, a sub-mode in Kirby Triple Deluxe, which also got an independent release on the eShop as Kirby Fighters Deluxe, or Kirby Fighters Z in the Japanese eShop. And this is very specifically a Smash-style game. You know, it uses a very similar control scheme to the core Kirby Triple Deluxe game, but it frames the game in a very similar style to Super Smash Bros. You know, you will fight a character, you'll fight characters, you'll fight bosses, you'll fight, like, a team boss. It's actually very focused on being very similar to Smash. And before Smash 4 came out on 3DS, I was playing this on my Japanese 3DS as, like, oh, this is the closest thing I can get to Smash for a couple of months.
Right.
So I think it's really cool. Slaggy, I played this with you. What do you think?
Yeah, it was cute. I mean, it's an all Kirby Smash Brothers, basically. You know, definitely, I don't want to say watered down, but, you know, definitely pared down to not be a full, you know, everything in the kitchen sink experience.
But it's very much like a basic.
It is. It's really cute.
Entry level kind of Smash. Well, kind of basic entry level melee fighting experience.
Agreed.
I'm very into it. I think it's very cool. And for the, what, $7.99 or whatever it is on eShop, I think
right.
It's a no-brainer.
And if you already own Kirby Triple Deluxe, you get access to, I think, what, two extra exclusive Kirbys?
You do, yeah. You get access to the Beetle Kirby and the Bell Kirby.
Aww.
Yeah. I also want to talk about a weird-ass little game. This released in Japan on December 18th, 2003 for the GameCube and PlayStation 2. This was called Dream Mix TV World Fighters. This is a crossover game of Hudson and Konami video game characters with Takara's toy lines. So you end up with stuff like Simon Belmont versus Solid Snake, Bomberman, and Megatron from Transformers.
What?
Yeah. The game itself is very similar to Smash 64. It came out more contemporaneous to Smash Melee, but from a gameplay perspective, it is closer to Smash 64. In fact, it even uses basically the same control style with, you know, the basic attack button and an action, like a special attack button. And even, like, jumps are handled the same way with, like, an up special and, you know, air jumps and what have you. It's very much a clone. Clearly, Konami saw Smash Brothers and thought we need to get in on that. The probably the most interesting thing is just that character roster. You have Simon Belmont, you have Twinbee, you have Power Pro Koon, who is the little ball-headed baseball player from the GKO Powerful Pro baseball series. Solid Snake, you have a Moai head from Gradius, you have Bomberman, you have Master Higgins from Adventure Island, you have Yugo from Bloody Roar, you have Momotaro from Momotaro, you have Sengoku Manjimaru from Tengai Makyo, you have Bean Bogami from Momotaro, you have Optimus Prime and Megatron from Transformers, you have Tyson Granger from Beyblade, you have Microman from Micronauts, you have Lika-chan, who is like the Japanese version of Barbie, and Asuka from Cool Girl. So it's just like this really weird, super nerdy game. It plays a little bit silly because, again, it came out around the time of Melee, but has the gameplay of Smash 64. But if you're into this kind of weird experience, I think it's worth looking into. I actually had a pre-order for this game. It's the only Japanese game I've ever pre-ordered because my local import store knew they were only getting one copy.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, yeah, when you get it in, please hold it for me. And they did. I put in a deposit and they held it for me. And they were like, people saw it in our case and wanted it, but we had a little sign on it that said it was already paid for. So nice. I love this game. Again, maybe because of that experience, I may look on it more fondly than it actually is. But again, from a gameplay perspective, it's almost identical to Smash. If you're looking for a Smash experience you haven't had, I would recommend this game.
Cool.
Next up is the Jump Ultimate Stars and Jump Superstars. These are two games developed by Bangarian for the Nintendo DS. Jump Superstars came out in Japan on August 8th, 2005. Jump Ultimate Stars came out November 23rd, 2006. Something very interesting about these games is that they were actually carried officially in a lot of North American stores. My local Best Buy sold both of these games. My local Fry's Electronics sold both of these games. You know, I just imported through my normal importers, but, you know, these are very much Smash clones again, very similar control style. Straight up, you have regular attacks, you have smash attacks, you have your up smash, you have your double jumps.
Mm-hmm. And you say notably released in your local Best Buy and Fry's, but this game was never domestically released because of all of the various jump franchising copyright.
Well, that's why I mean notable that it was available in these stores, because this was, again, much like Dream Mix TV World Fighters, this is a Japan-only release, which is why it was notable that it was carried in a lot of stores domestically in North America, because you could buy this game all over the country in North America at real, you know, big-box retailers, but it was not actually released here. There was a lot of licensing issues. You had characters from Black Cat, Bleach, Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo, Buso Renkin, Death Note, Gray
Man. Say that one again after you...
Dragon Ball.
Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo. Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo.
Dragon Ball, Dr. Slump, Eye Shield 21, Gintama, Hunter Cross Hunter, Hikaru no Go, Strawberry 100%. JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which obviously is huge right now, Hitman Reborn, Mr. Full Swing, Naruto, One Piece, Rurouni Kenshin, Shaman King, Slam Dunk, Steel Ball Run, which is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, but whatever, Prince of Tennis, Yu-Gi-Oh!, and Yu Yu Hakusho. So, like, this would have been a licensing mess. So it never came out in North America officially, but it was available in North America. It was very easy to buy. I know a lot of people who own these games.
Well, you know all those Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo fans.
I believe Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo was actually released in North America and even aired on Cartoon Network for a while, the anime.
Really?
So there are a lot of Bo-Bo fans.
Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo?
I want to say the North American version only used two or three bows. It was either Bobo or Bobobo, but whatever. This isn't Anime Buoy.
Bobo. Bobo.
Either way, great game. Should be pretty easy to find copies of.
Yeah, I
the
played...
The DS is obviously super region-free, and it has some really great... what is that called? Download play?
Yes, I was just going to say that my experience with this is playing download play with you.
Yeah, and you know, that works really well. It's very cool, and I'm a huge fan of both of these games, Ultimate Stars and Superstars. In fact, I would say in a lot of ways, those are probably the best games on this list. Another game that I'm a huge fan of, though, was the Full Metal Alchemist Dream Carnival. This was a PS2 game that released in Japan on August 26th, 2004.
Oh, wow.
And it's just very specifically a Smash clone, very similar to other, you know, Smash clones. I really feel like Smash set up a very specific sort of set of expectations and even like controller techniques, not entirely dissimilar to how Street Fighter 2 sort of showed what a 2D fighter should play like. All of these melee fighting games, Smash clones, play very, very similarly. So if you're into Full Metal Alchemist and you like melee fighters, I would definitely recommend you check this one out.
Excellent.
A very similar game we have is Battle Stadium DON, which is a Japanese crossover fighting game. The D stands for Dragon Ball, the O stands for One Piece, and the N stands for Naruto. And again, it's a GameCube and PlayStation 2 game released in Japan on July 20th, 2006. Playable characters were Son Goku, Son Gohan, Piccolo, Vegeta, Trunks, Majin Buu, Cell, Frieza, One Piece had Monkey D. Luffy, Roronoa Zoro, Sanji, Tony Chopper, Nami, and Usopp, and Naruto had Naruto, Sasuke, Sakura, Kakashi, Rock Lee, and Gaara. And this game, it plays a little jank. This probably more than anything, for me at least, is influenced by the fact that it came out after Melee. Because, you know, it's cool, I love the character selection, I'm a big fan of Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, and Naruto. But it's really problematic that the game controls really sluggishly, it's very floaty. And, you know, the game, the way that the gameplay worked was that rather than zoning people out when they have a low percentage or heart meter or whatever, you had to collect a bunch of orbs in play, and if the timer ran down while no one had any orbs, the timer just got extended. So I remember some matches of this game going on for way too long because I was playing with people who were super trollish and just wouldn't let the timer go down. They'd like, no, I have to hit you and knock those orbs out of you before the timer's up. It was really irritating. It was super irritating. Messy game. I don't really recommend it unless you're a big anime fan, but I know I'm not the only one. Quite a few of our listeners, I tweet about anime games now and anime shows and manga. So, you know, those you guys out there, you might actually be interested in this game. It's worth checking out, but it's somewhat hard to find. I had to get mine off Amazon used for like $65 a few years back, which is a lot more than I've paid for most import GameCube games. So, the next one is probably the most high-profile game on this list. And it's probably the one you were expecting me to mention first off. That is PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, developed by Superbot Entertainment in association with Sony Computer Entertainment, Santa Monica, published, of course, by Sony Computer Entertainment, released on the PlayStation 3 and PlayStation Vita, North America, November 20th, 2012, EU territories, November 21st, 2012, Australia, November 22nd, 2012, UK territories, November 23rd, 2012, and in Japan on January 31st, 2013. This game, of course, gets a lot of flack for playing very similar to Smash Brothers, but you only can be killed by another player's super attack. So you're spending your entire time playing just building up super meter in order to use a super attack. If you use a super attack and blow your meter, all your effort has been wasted and you better build some more super meter before someone else gets you. It had a really cool character roster, except that it had quite a bit of, how do we say, there was a lot of promotional consideration made in terms of what third-party characters showed up. So while the character roster had some really cool characters like Cole from Infamous, Fat Princess, Jack and Daxter, Cat from Gravity Rush, Kratos from God of War, Nariko from A Heavenly Sword, Nathan Drake from Uncharted,
Sackboy,
Parappa the Rapper, Sackboy, Sir Daniel Fortesque from Medieval, Sly Cooper, Spike from Ape Escape, Sweet Tooth from Twisted Metal. You also ended up with, like, a Bioshock Big Daddy, New Dante from Devil May Cry, Heihachi Mishima from Tekken, Raiden from Metal Gear, which, you know, it's all well and good to have crossover characters. Obviously, I'm a big fan of when Smash finally did it. But again, doing it in this first game and having a large percentage of your roster be guest characters, you know, we didn't mention his name, but Isaac Clarke from Dead Space was also in it. It's just like, it felt more like an advertisement. And when combined with the fact that it was it played like a slower Smash Brothers game, and it tried to be more technical, but lost it because of the focus on this special, you can only get people out with a super move. Ultimately, most people felt like the game just sort of didn't live up to its potential.
Yeah, I got this for free with my PS3, the second one I ended up getting. So, yeah, it was okay for a free game.
I think that's how most people who play this game feel. It's okay for a game I didn't pay for, but I don't think that speaks too highly of the game. So, again, it's really easy to get your hands on. It's available on PS3 and Vita. It's on sale often. It has been a free game on PlayStation Plus.
Well, remember the whole issue with Superbot and Santa Monica taking over the DLC, and then they didn't really do any more DLC?
It's not really an issue per se.
No, just I mean that we've talked about that on the show.
The game underperformed. Superbot got closed because of it. Sony Santa Monica was brought on to finish the DLC that was already in the pipeline. They claimed that they were going to do more, but, no one bought the DLC they did. There was no real reason to, and things sort of fizzled. It sucks because Superbot had some really great design work done for some further DLC that would have been great. Abe from the Oddworld games, which admittedly third-party guests, but that's a cool one. And the Oddworld games on console have a very interesting relationship with the PlayStation platforms, because they were initially PlayStation exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Dart from Legend of Dragoon was going to be coming out, and I know that's a series that has a lot of very devoted fans that really would love to see that game get some love. So it's just a shame that things turned out with that game the way they did. I would have liked to have seen that game do better, even if it was a try-hard clone, just because I think that there was a lot of room there for them to grow and sort of look at new interesting gameplay ideas.
Mm.
The last two I want to talk about are both Ouya exclusives-ish.
Oh, yeah.
The first, of course, is Towerfall. This is the game that we initially were calling the main reason to own an Ouya. It is now available on PlayStation 4 and has been a free game on PlayStation 4 for PS Plus. It's also available on Microsoft Windows, Linux, and OS X via the Steam Store. This is a melee fighting style game, but rather than the focus being on, your special moves and your regular attacks and jumping, it is just about hitting your opponents with an arrow.
Yep.
And because this game design is, in theory, so simplistic, the gameplay experiences end up really emergent and crazy. You end up with all kinds of really interesting and cool things happening. I think this is an amazing game. If you're looking for not a Smash clone, but just a really great game in a similar style, I highly, 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 highly recommend you check this one out. The PS4 and Steam versions, I think, have demos. The Ouya version definitely has a demo, because that's where I played it for the first time, and then I immediately bought it. I have bought this game 3 times over, and I do not regret it. Amazing experience. I highly recommend you check it out. And last, but certainly not least, is Duck Game for the Ouya. This was a game made by Landon Podbielski. It has 50 different levels, 4 ducks to choose from, as well as a few non-duck characters. And it's basically like a hybrid of a melee fighter and like a twin stick shooter.
Yeah, I played it for the first time at GamerX 2.
Yeah, and this is currently an Ouya exclusive, but it is coming to PC. It's being brought over actually by Adult Swim Games to Steam.
Wow.
Yeah. So, it's unlikely that you have an Ouya that's hooked up. If you do, I highly recommend you check this out. It's a great game. It's associated with GamerX, so you're supporting, good people. And, otherwise, I would say when it hits Steam, I would definitely recommend you check it out. It's deceptively simple, because it's really cool, and the gameplay has a lot of depth when you're playing with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
All right, well, that about wraps it up for our discussion here. So let's get on to...
Rumor has it.
So, rumor has it that an adaptation of Chair Entertainment and Epic Games' Infinity Blade series will be arriving on the Xbox One as Infinity Blade Saga.
Huh.
As far as we can tell, based on a report from A9VG, Saga will include most of the stages and scenarios found within the 3 existing Infinity Blade games on iOS. Apparently, there will also be additional storyline elements. It appears that the Kinect will be supported as a playstyle, with controllers also being an option. We have a lot of information on this game because while no official announcement has been made, which is why we're talking about it on Rumor Has It, there has already been a lot of, like, spy footage showing this game running on the Xbox One. So it seems like a sure thing, but since it hasn't been announced, heck, it could exist but still be canceled, we don't want to talk about it as, like, a main news item yet.
Yeah, and the Infinity Blade games had, you know, for iOS games, pretty impressive graphics.
Oh, yeah, they're gorgeous. In fact, they were, like, showpieces for the iOS hardware, or the iPhone hardware for a long time. And, you know, that's it for rumors, but we do have another article in our previously known as Smash segment. This is, of course, an article that we would like you to read if you're interested in how games journalism is handled in the modern age. This is a great piece on Wired by Chris Kohler that is specifically about how Sean Layden, the new president and CEO of Computer Entertainment America, brought Vib Ribbon to America for the first time. I like this piece because you don't need to know anything about this news story before you read it. It gives you the beginning, the middle, and the end, why Vib Ribbon needed to come to North America when it did, why that situation existed, which is, of course, Sean Layden talking about Vib Ribbon on his E3 keynote, despite that game having never been released here and not following it up with any kind of announcement relating to Vib Ribbon. And it also has, you know, a lot of insight from Layden about how he feels about the game and why he felt like it was personally important and important to the fans to bring this game to North America after implying a promise that he didn't even properly make. But he felt like by showing it and talking it up, he was obligated to at least bring the original game over, and he made good on it in a really short period of time.
Yeah.
I just thought this was a great piece. I like the story. I think this is the kind of article we should be supporting and reading. And if you're interested in writing about games, I think this is a great place to start looking at, like, how would I like to approach games writing? Do you have anything to say about this article?
No, just that even if you're familiar with the story and have been following it here on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
That is still a great read.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's start up the wrap-up with our What's Up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
So the first game I played that I want to talk about is Hyrule Warriors. You know, I bought Hyrule Warriors because I wanted some Club Nintendo points so that I could order my Smash Brothers 4 posters. I didn't really intend on playing the game. I figured I'd give it away to someone at some point or something. I'm not a big Zelda fan. But I actually, upon playing it, have turned out to really effing love it.
Well, it's very Dynasty Warriors.
Well, something I was shocked about while playing it is that it doesn't, for me, feel like a Zelda game at all. It just feels like a Musou game with Zelda characters.
There's a lot of fan service.
Oh, there's a ton of Zelda fan service. But in terms of gameplay, like, I keep seeing people like, oh, this isn't like any other Musou. This is Hyrule, or Zelda Musou. This is Hyrule Warriors. But, like, no, if you like Hyrule Warriors for gameplay reasons, you should go buy some of those $7.99 Dynasty Warriors games, because they are for you. I like Dynasty Warriors games. There was no shade in that. They're just not super popular in North America, although that could change with all of this love Hyrule Warriors is getting.
Yeah.
But I was really impressed. I think it's great. I think it plays just like a Musou game, but I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
of course, with that Nintendo polish.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, you get really picky about Musou games being kind of functionally silly, but to me, that's half the fun.
You know, having that Assassin's Creed Unity frame rate?
You know, you go on about the frame rate, but the way that Hyrule Warriors handles it is that characters literally just disappear in front of you rather than bog down the frame rate. I don't know that I'd call that better.
No.
So, I don't know. I prefer having 1,000 characters on screen, even if it drops the frame rate down, rather than, okay, well, here's 40 and the rest are invisible, but they're still there. Either way, though, great gameplay experience.
Yeah, I played a little bit with you and had some fun.
I'm really enjoying earning weapons. I used that spinner thing that the Link amiibo can unlock in the game. That was super fun. I'm definitely going to play more of it, and I was not expecting that. I've also been playing a lot of World of Warcraft, Warlords of Draenor.
Congrats on your 100.
Got my main to 100, I got my garrison built up to level 3, I've done my run through Molten Core and gotten my Fire Helmet and Molten Corgi and my Flame Core mount.
I'm a little bit behind you, as you know, but the listeners out there might not know. I'm also 100, but still just a little bit less geared, so I'm trying to catch up to you.
Yeah, I'm loving it. I'm probably more into WoW now than I have been in the last 5 years. Very, very exciting time for me. I had a great deal of fun.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly looking forward to playing. Playing doesn't feel like a chore like it did at one time.
Indeed.
I've also started up my game of Pokemon Omega Ruby.
Nice. Did you choose the Mudkip?
I did. In fact, his name is Perd Hapley. Based on Perd Hapley from Parks and Recreation, who has a show on Parks and Recreation called You Heard with Perd.
Oh, and I heard you like Mudkips.
Exactly.
Well done.
I'm really enjoying it. Has a lot of the polish from X and Y. It feels more polished than X and Y so far. I am missing the character customization stuff, but I'm really enjoying exploring this world. I'm enjoying the graphics. I think look great.
The original Ruby and Sapphire had been kind of, like, in some ways the black sheep because they took a lot of features away, but, you know, a lot of people really having a good time with the games.
Yeah, I'm loving it. And then the other big thing, obviously, was Smash. I've talked about that a lot here.
Yep.
So, I also bought a new PS3 because my old one has died on me too many times and it won't run anymore. And with Kingdom Hearts 2.5 HD Remix this week,
it was
time because I cannot miss that. The Birth by Sleep is one of my favorite games I've played in the last 10 years. And the idea of playing it again in HD definitely appeals to me enough that I needed to make sure I could get on board that.
Yeah, the PS3 still has life in it.
So Slaggy, what about you? What have you been playing?
I already covered all of it with my interruptions.
All right. Well, then I think it's time for our social links. Obviously, I want to implore our listeners to tweet at us, hashtag GameBuoyExtra. Are you a Smash fan? Are you a Smash fan? What's your favorite game in the series? Who is your main? Just anything about Smash, tweet at us.
Yeah,
email
anything
us,
you want to talk about.
Facebook like us, it's all good.
Your introduction to the series, etc. You can reach us, we'll give you those social links in a minute. But I'd say we got an iron horde of tweets since our last episode. First up, from Lil Daddy's Pizza, hey, says, it was fun to hear about what happened to WoW since I quit 7 years ago. Yeah, the game has really changed immensely. So, you know, it's really an interesting story. I agree. And we're glad you enjoyed it. Emiru69 said, listening and enjoying the last episode while playing Smash, and I don't even play WoW. Love your podcast.
Aww. Thank you.
Hulkling79, better known as Phil from the Koopa Club podcast, said, hella good WoW episode, you guys. You entertained me all the way to San Diego and back. Aw. And, Phil, someone who recently returned to the game, and from what I know, loving it. Your Enzyme says, I am ashamed. I was too wrapped up playing Warlords of Draenor to answer your question for the podcast. And then said, also, congrats on saying Bandai Namco properly. You've been doing well with that. No more Bandai Namkai.
I have literally been practicing in my off hours to make sure I don't do that anymore. Because of how much I love all of you.
Aww. We were tagged in a link from Rob Roberts, a.k.a. Sky, on Twitter. Said, check out people from OLR, Horde House, Koopa Club, Game Bar, GameBuoy.org, and linked to the podcast Crosszone 2 panel, which we had, you know, said has been a... which we had previously mentioned is now available as a GamerX Talks over on the GamerX channel. Morning Wolf says, please, please, please do a BioWare episode. Then, how about a Bethesda episode?
Wait, someone asked for a BioWare episode?
Yeah. Hashtag GameBuoyExtra, hashtag GameBuoyRocks. Aw. Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about a BioWare episode today.
We made a...
We did, and I think that's where Morning Wolf was picking up on, but, you know... it sounds like there is a demand for it, so we should.
Yeah, you know, we're
talk about that. I have some ideas, but let's talk about that off air.
Yeah, okay.
We got a tweet from GamerFox saying, respect, OLR, Horde House, GameBuoy.org, Koopa Club, Game Bar, Sky, Fidel, Toopsy, Fix Your Face, Spike Point, Dark Sakura, which was in response to the Gamer X2 podcast Crosszone 2. So well done to the podcast Crosszone Hunties.
Yay!
Oh, hey, DJ, a big-time smasher and a smash shirt artist and all-type sexiness, says, I hope you're listening to Game Bar, GameBuoy.org, Koopa Club, and VG Realness. Part of the Hunty Bunch, yes! We got another tweet from Emiru69 saying, good, so many good podcasts to listen to. Just finished the last episode of Koopa Club, GameBuoy.org, OLR, and Saving Game Bar for tonight. So, ooh, I bet that was a sexy night. And with that, you know, we just want to thank you so much for all your tweets, your Facebook likes, to all our Twitter followers. You know, there's so many of you. Well, there's not so many of you, but there's more of you than I would have expected. You know, we used to joke about being the show with one listener, and you've definitely shown us the love, and, you know, we really appreciate that. We love your feedback. We like your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We like your Facebook likes. We effing love Twitter.
We effing love it.
Probably my favorite social media site. You can also tumble with us on Tumblr. You know, definitely trying to, my New Year's resolution for Game Buoys, kind of step up our Tumblr game. You can also plus one us on Google Plus if you're one of those folks. You can email us anytime at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org. Stop. Our home base is gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
This has our complete episode archive and show notes and all of that sort of thing, along with a list of our social links right there on the sidebar. And with that, I think it's time to shout out some shout outs. Spike.
As ever and always, I want to give my first shout out to Koopa Club. That is Koopa with a Q, Club with a K. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist.
What award did they win?
I believe it was one from their mothers. Or maybe your mother.
Hey!
I also want to mention
my mom's not cool enough.
VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, as well as the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I'd be remiss not to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I steal so many of my cues. Last, but certainly not least in the gaming sphere, is the Nintendo Fun Club podcast, Platformers, Positivity, and Pop Punk. In non-gaming podcast suggestions and recommendations, I'd be remiss not to point you in the direction of Reading is Fundamental. This is...
Yes, God.
This is Slagkick's show about logos.
It's not just my show.
Hit series RuPaul's Drag Race, featuring myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness. I love my Hunty Bunch girls so
much. Yes, and you know, you were telling me that a casting season 7 reveal special
December 7th at 6:30.
Yeah, so I guess time to dust off the library cards.
Oh, are you excited for it?
Yeah.
I also want to mention the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail, as well as the X Nation podcast over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. And last but certainly not least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Now, Slaggy, why don't you take us to a game bar?
Game Bar, the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. They're basically the gay video game Prairie Home Companion Lindsay Lohan edition, and part of the Hunty Bunch. We'd be remiss not to mention the Nerdgasm Network, the wildest shock jock video game radio show that you'll ever come across is a bag of hot dicks. Over on Voice of Geeks Network, you can hear two great shows about online gaming. One is Horde House, the place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously, and who we kind of had an homage to last episode. And Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. With Still in the Game over there, making me wish I could roll on a EU server. I guess I technically could, but the lag would be terrible. And last but certainly not least, La Palanca podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. We'd also like to recognize that our wonderful theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to reorchestrate Zelda music in beautiful symphonic sound, and for whom we'll be forever pouring out a 40.
With all that having been said, thank you so much for spending your time with us this lovely Sunday afternoon. It has been a real pleasure talking to you, and we, as always, appreciate you having spent your time with us. We have something really fun for you guys in another f***ing week or two, but in the meantime, keep gaming, keep thinking, and... Mics are hot.
Hot mics, hot mics. Get your hot mics.
All right, our loves look good. Is there anything you need before we start?
Nope.
On to some...
Oh my god, news.
Oh my god.
Miku fans who, you know, really helped her become popular. Really helped her... In other Square Enix news, we have the news...
Wah, wah.
I'm actually not going to include that sound because it would be really disrespectful.
Yeah.
And I don't know for sure whether this is owing to the fact that the GameCube tournament level player, Guilty Gear player. And something interesting about Smash 4 is that both versions of Smash 4 have completely different assist trophies. Both versions have some assist trophies in common. Dream Mix TV Superstars or whatever the hell that game is called. We have something really fun for you guys in another fucking week or two. Please look forward to it.
Rumor has it.